It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on to you the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And I want to begin by apologizing for Zoom in not allowing all of you to enter the talk last week. And I just want to say that Zoom was extremely responsive. And everyone on my team is thinking that the problem is fixed. But I'm sorry for the waste of your time. Today, the talk is about Katagiri Roshi. To me, he's just Katagiri. I mean, he was just this ubiquitous figure that we called sensei. And he was scurrying around and helping and assisting and doing. He was always everywhere. And this was in the days when Suzuki Roshi was purchasing and establishing San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara Zen Mountain Center, both places where I lived and both places where Katagiri also lived. My whole 11 years at the San Francisco Zen community was under his watch. His Dharma grandfather, Oka Sotan Roshi, you can see this on the chart that I have posted, was also the Dharma grandfather of Suzuki Roshi and Sawaki Roshi. And Okumura Roshi, who practiced with Katagiri briefly in Japan, babysat in his Minnesota Zen Center after Katagiri died, Okumura Roshi was the abbot of Katagiri's temple in Minnesota. So Katagiri isn't part of this triumvirate, that's the subject of this series, but he was in the mix with everybody, including Suzuki Roshi, who's also not in this triumvirate. As for a vow, Katagiri said, "The wholehearted practice of Zazen is itself living by vow," which makes him a total heart son of Dogen. So I feel like he belongs in this series, and that's why I'm presenting him today and next week, which is our final talk in the series. So next week, I'll talk more about his vow. But today, I'd like to present two other views of Katagiri that I think will interest you. And the first is by Robert Thurman, and I've read parts of this to you in the past, but he's terrific. He's the father of actor Uma Thurman. He's a great buddy of the Dalai Lama. And he's one of the world's outstanding comedians. And one time I attended a very long retreat with the Dalai Lama. And every night, because he was in such demand, Robert Thurman gave a talk and had everybody just rolling on the floors. He's really something. He's such a practitioner and such a scholar and such a human. And he taught for a while at Columbia. I don't know if he still teaches there, but he begins, "Dainin Katagiri Roshi returns to silence and he speaks." Returns to Silence is the book that is the cause of Robert Thurman speaking at this time. He's promoting Katagiri's new book, Returning to Silence. So Robert Thurman says, he is one of America's great Zen masters, and he dares to begin his beautiful work, returning to silence when we think. And Thurman says, think, because when we return to silence, which is Zazen, we don't think. So that's why he's saying he dares to begin his beautiful work, returning to silence when we think. And then Thurman says, Katagiri Roshi is my friend. He likes me. I like him. We look at each other and feel rested, each sensing in how tired the other is, sharing determination. We must always try to, quote, accept all sentient beings as the contents of our life. When I am with Katagiri, I feel as I used to when I was with my late Dharma father, great Geshe Wangyal, whom I mentioned for a purpose, for the sake of fullness, to hold nothing back. And as I do when I'm with some Lama friends, cheerful and content, but a bit on edge, as if many more people were there with us. Robert Thurman is—he's trying to do full disclosure because he's a Tibetan Buddhist, and of course we're all Zen Buddhists, and so he's saying, "I just want to be completely transparent." And so he feels a bit on edge, as if many more people were there with us, which I am with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I feel at least 6 million. Tibetans were with us in the room, and around them, inconceivable multitudes of feeling beings. When I am with Katagiri Roshi, I feel the hundreds of millions of Japan, not just Japan of this moment, but Japan as it has grown over a millennium. The people of Basho's green leaf floating, the delicate people teeming on the broad green leaf in the bright sun of Vairochana's mirror of form. This is all Robert Thurman's writing. He's so good. And woven between us all are so many peoples in between, especially peoples of the snowy northlands, Yukat, Buryat, Inui, Tlingit, down to the earthy Winnebago and Ojibwa of Katagiri's Minnesota woods, all sentient beings, all feeling beings. Feelings are inconceivable. I am honored to introduce Katagiri's deep and beautiful Sakuhachi speech. It took me too long to read it. I still have not read every word. It's not a book to get through. It's a book to live in. Many books are read in pausing from life, when you take some time off, when you escape and put everything on hold. This book is such. When you live in it, you are outside of it, more in life. Read it a little and keep it near your place. Let it be a friend. Let it help you keep the trivia in perspective. From the very beginning, the book corners you. Katagiri Roshi plainly tells us the opportunity to experience real silence occurs when we have been driven into a corner and simply cannot move an inch. And he advises wisely that it only takes transcending desire to turn despair at being cornered into real silence, Buddhist silence, the total manifestation of our whole personality. What a book, what a great gift to open us to our corner, to show us how being absolutely trapped is the total freedom of being with all beings. Katagiri Roshi can do this because he speaks without budging from such a corner. He speaks in the totality of such silence. He and the corner and his words and the silence are among the dimensions of the book. Its cover opens and its inconceivability is accessed in our eye and brain and heart and our mind and the book and Katagiri and boundless crying and laughing Buddhas are all together in the bliss dimensions. Of course, not one specific detail is obliterated. The bliss dimension is undiluted clarity and exquisite sensitivity. We are gripped when we share that dimension with an American pilot of the Great Pacific War, parachuting into Japan and injuring himself. We become the Japanese medic, Senri Uyeno, who sought to help him against orders, but ultimately was falsely accused of killing him and was executed for this deed he did not commit. We become the poem he wrote before his death when he says, putting myself in another's place without flinching, no matter how hard and heartrending it is to live. We are gratefully cornered. And I believe I've read you the full poem of this person once. Let's find happiness by ourselves, he's quoting, within silver tears like pearls and laughter as the sun. Let's keep walking ahead each day. Katagiri is generous too. He lets us all be with the awesome poet, find the stunning poetry in the mouth of a supposed war criminal of the grisly past, a man whose death was a wound between us, America and Japan. Even on the outermost level of this completeness, there is a shining resurrection from that death. Katagiri's description of supreme knowledge meets the realm of peerless Shantideva. With supreme knowledge, we can see one beautiful picture where two things are constantly interchanging. This is the place in which we have to stand up. I cannot survive without all of you. I can help because others are not other. Others are the contents of my life. Others are completely embraced by my life. My life can be found with others' lives. At that time, I can do something with full commitment. And he connects it with the sublime earthiness of matchless Dogen, who says, we can help in many ways. Using toilet paper carefully is helping others. Don't expect helping to be a big deal. In our everyday life, we can help someone or something all the time. Katagiri makes his biggest statement when he unfurls Dogen Zenji's banner of Zazen, the sitting as Buddha, that is the goal of all Buddhism, the goal of all life, the true entrance, foundation, and ultimate goal of all religion. He initiates us in Dogen's seamless monument mandala of perfect religious security. Just sitting, Zen, is eternal peak experience, the realm of end in itself. Katagiri offers it to us all, whether we be Christian, Jewish, atheist, or hedonist. Zazen penetrates and is available to all circles of human beings. Skiing, basketball, dancing, whatever you do, this is basic universal practice because we create life anew day after day. This is the peak of the book as well. This is where we are allowed to sit when we read it. This reminds us there is nothing more important. It reminds us it is not only a just sitting, it is an exclusive sitting, an initiated sacred sitting that excludes all egotistic ordinariness of means and ends. A sitting that is just, that is exact, exactly balancing absolute and relative, exactly here and everywhere, that is total, totally embracing life and death, sterility and fertility, good and evil, love and hate, and all ordinary opposites in harmony. Katagiri ends with some of the best advice for Buddhist social action I have yet seen. Taking in comment on Dogen's essay on the four methods of guidance, which can be also the four social graces or even the four political practices. These four are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. I've taught you these actually. And I called them the four embracing dharmas. And apparently until Dogen, no one had taken these teachings from Shakyamuni. And I guess Dogen named them the four embracing dharmas. And this section in Katagiri Roshi's book, Thurman is saying, touches the beginning of a bodhisattva movement to save the world, the untiring messianic action to free all beings from suffering. It is why Buddhists love America and will make America finally come to life. Those who would be these new age bodhisattvas should read this good advice with eager hearts until it penetrates their skin, muscle, and bone. That's a reference to Dogen. I won't go into it. But, you know, it's interesting. This book was written some years ago, and it has a different feel in today's climate, actually. Well, I'll stop there with that. The second glance I'd like to share with you is, it comes from a manuscript called Ceaseless Effort, The Life of Dainin Katagiri. And it's adapted from research done by his student, Andrea Martin, on a personal quest to learn more about her teacher's life. And she says it's not an official biography, but I think it's really good and it's very heartfelt. And she did a ton of work. And so I'm gonna read some passages of it for you. And she says, so Katagiri or Dainin, which means great patience, the Dharma name he got at ordination. For a long time, he avoided it for his childhood name, Yoshiyuki, which means good luck. But as a young priest, his master had to keep reminding him to use his ordination name, which he was avoiding because he misunderstood the word. His name means great patience, and he thought, and he didn't like to be patient. So he thought, oh no, you know, I don't want to have this name. But he misunderstood that the patience that was being elicited from his name is the patience of a bodhisattva waiting to attain enlightenment till all other beings have attained enlightenment. That's the vow of a bodhisattva. And it requires great patience. So that's the, it took Katagiri a while to catch on to that was the patience of his name, not just, you know, if he's stuck in traffic being patient, it's not that kind of patience. So when he was a kid, he had nine siblings and his parents ran a restaurant and they were always busy with the restaurant. So they left parenting to his siblings and he didn't ever feel very close to his parents therefore. But he said that they were devoted Pure Land Buddhist followers. They were Pure Land Buddhists and they had a prayer session every morning. And so he was just like, he says, my parents put me right in the middle of a religious mood. So I accepted my vocation with my whole body through my pores. And he says, I didn't understand it then, but now I really appreciate it. It was a big help. And during the war, he entered the Army Air Force serving as an aircraft engineer mechanic. And so by that time, the restaurant and his home had been destroyed. And he went to work as an engineer to produce a diesel engine to help support them. But still, they didn't have enough food and housing was very hard. And transportation was like, you know, people were killing each other just to get on the train. And And he was still working, building diesel engines. And he thought, should I spend my whole life like this? So one day he went with a high school friend to a Shin Buddhist temple. And it felt very peaceful there, as it had when he had visited a Zen monastery before and after the war. And he said, I was very impressed by monastic life because it was not changed by the war. Everyday routines, zazen, chanting sutras, morning service, afternoon service, everything was exactly the same. And the atmosphere was tranquil and peaceful. He says, I was very impressed, so I decided to become a monk. His root teacher, this is interesting, his root teacher, whose last name was Hayashi, was abbot of Taizouin, where Katagiri went to live with his teacher. But his teacher was just, he says, I had a big hope. So Katagiri says, I had a big hope as a monk. I wanted to study Buddhism, but my teacher didn't teach me anything. He was just present. We walked together and did some of the same things together. And he told me, you have to absorb it. But I felt bored. I wanted to have excitement. So I asked, why don't you give me something? Why don't you teach me? And he said, why haven't you asked me? Big shock. And this was a lesson. We need to request the teachings. You know, I've talked about this too, regarding questions and answers. When you ask a question, you aren't just asking a question. You're requesting the Buddhist teachings. And then I offer, you know, my understanding of the Buddhist teachings. That's what that's about. And so it's important that you ask a question, even if you think it's a dumb question. But Katagiri says, still day by day, I suffered. And finally, I told my teacher, I would like to give up being a Zen monk. I want to convert to the Pure Land school. I was very familiar with Pure Land because of my parents. I would not have to get up early in the morning and do zazen. My teacher said, oh yes, if you want, but wherever you go, everything is the same. Big shock. I was trying to do something with my excitement, my hope, but all this hope was snuffed out like pouring water over a fire. Later, he recalls, my teacher didn't have an exciting, dramatic life. The main characteristic of his life was very quiet. He lived in celibacy. He didn't say much. He was always just going along like a stream of water. Whatever happened, he never changed his attitude. No matter what I did, whatever mistake I made, even when I grumbled and was mad at him, his way was just to go along as always. This was very nice, but I hated it because I was always looking for something exciting. I was always greedy, but my teacher didn't care. He just lived. He just let me be alive every day. But then finally, in 1947, several years later, Katagiri arrived at Eheiji, which is Dogen's temple. Everything was completely different. Chanting sutras, morning service, standing, walking, eating. I was really impressed. And every day I saw myself changing and fitting into everything. I had never experienced such a calm, very scheduled, rhythmical existence. Before, I was always thinking of myself. But at Eheiji, I didn't have any way to think of me. I had to follow the schedule, think about what to do next, pay attention to other people's behavior. So very naturally, my life was really changing every day. That was pretty good for me. During 8 weeks of intensive study of Dogen, Katagiri met Eiko Hashimoto Roshi, a famous Zen center and student of Oka Soton, who's the one who's the grandfather Dharma teacher of all the people that we're studying right now. When Katagiri was at Eheiji, Hashimoto was the monk in charge of training, and he emphasized discipline and monastic rules. And Katagiri served as his anja, which is his daily life attendant, for a year. And he says, I helped cleaning in his clothes, making tea for him. And when guests came, I served tea. So I was very close to him every day, just like mother and child. I was very lucky, and he was very lucky to be anja to such a great being. And so Hashimoto Roshi became Katagiri's second teacher, our practice teacher. He had three teachers, and the key person inspiring his religious life, someone from whom I learned how great Zazen was, and from whom I understood what the practice of Dogen's Buddhism was. He said that Hashimoto Roshi saw deeply into Dogen's practice and wanted to follow Dogen's principle of life. He was a great teacher. He really embodied the spirit of the monk's life every day through the actions of everyday life. He met his wife Tomei through Tomei's English teacher, Miss Tanaka. She was 28 and he was 32. And through a kind of formal arrangement, but they had a 30-year marriage and had two sons and now three grandsons. Also, he recalls that he was invited to be the first member of the Institute for Propagating Zen Buddhism in North America, but he got bored actually doing that. And he wanted to go to college, and he wanted to go to college and study English, which he did. I have witnessed that he did need to study English. And he actually had gotten a sort of student's room at San Francisco State, and he was all set to, that's what he wanted to do. He was all set, went to wait for school to start, and he was gonna study English at San Francisco State and live like a student. But he was caught by Jean Ross, one of Suzuki Roshi's American students. And when she had visited Japan, and apparently Katagiri helped her out when she was in Japan. And now she recommended me to help Zen Center, he says. She said, please don't live separately from Zen Center. Please help us. I was not agreed, but she constantly recommended me. Just see Suzuki Roshi. So Katagiri says, so I went to Sokoji Zen Temple. That's where Suzuki Roshi was at the time, to see him. And he immediately said, that's a good opportunity. Please help us. Even though I decided I wanted to go one way, here was a completely different way. So I was completely caught by Suzuki Roshi. Then I met the students of Zen Center and they said, please come, please help us. I was completely caught by everybody. And finally, I couldn't say no. So I decided to come to Sokoji anyway. So here are some of the most important points. First, personally in my mind, I really apologize to my teacher, but I cannot stay feeling guilty. I don't know if I read you this part actually, but this is very important. Personally in my mind, I apologize to my teacher, but I can't stay feeling guilty. The more I feel guilty. This is to his first teacher because he left. He left and he went to Aheiji. And he says, he apologizes to his teacher. He was his teacher's only disciple. So he sort of left him a little bit high and dry, but he's entitled to do what he feels is best for his practice. And he says, I cannot stay feeling guilty. The more I feel guilty, the more I have to devote myself, offering my life to Buddha Dharma. That is the best way of apologizing. It's an important point. We can't stay feeling guilty any time. This goes for all of us all the time. We can't stay feeling guilty. And the best way to apologize is to offer your life to the Buddha Dharma. That is, do zazen, practice zazen. And the second important point, the opportunity to experience real silence occurs when we have been driven into a corner and simply cannot move an inch. That's a really important point. And third, Robert Thurman's statement, I cannot survive without all of you. I cannot help because others are not other. Others are the contents of my life. This is a very basic tenet of Buddhism. I think of all of Buddhism, not just Zen Buddhism. I cannot survive without all of you. I can help because others are not other. Others are the contents of my life. If you look carefully, you will see that is so true all the time. Fourth, at Aheiji, I didn't have any way to think of me. I had to follow the schedule, think about what to do next, and pay attention to other people's behavior. So very naturally, my life was really changing every day. This training of one thing after another and having to always look and follow what everyone else was doing. And so he couldn't think of himself. And he changed very much by the training of non-self-clinging. And the fifth important point, the wholehearted practice of zazen is itself living by vow. That's what Katagiri thinks. The wholehearted practice of zazen is itself living by vow. And here are some ideas for reflection during the week. First, Katagiri advises wisely that it only takes transcending desire to turn despair at being cornered into real silence, Buddha silence, the total manifestation of our whole personality, which is zazen. The next time you feel despair at being cornered, try transcending your desire. You know, why do I want this so much? Basically, that's what transcending your desire would involve. Why do I want this so much? And then do zazen. It might turn some of your hardest times into realization. It's wonderful advice. So that's a reflection point for the week, looking for times when you feel cornered and see if you can transcend your desire and do zazen. Secondly, we can help in many ways. Using toilet paper carefully is helping others. Do you agree? I mean, what would be the logic behind this somewhat radical statement? why would Dogen say such a thing? And then third, my parents put me right in the middle of a religious mood, so I accepted my vocation with my whole body through my pores. This is part of the rationale of monastic life. It's like total immersion for language learning also. How might this statement be useful to you? To you in particular, how could you change your life based on this understanding? And the fourth one is, this comes from the text, I was very impressed by monastic life because it was not changed by the war. And he means this in a kind of procedural way. They did the same thing every day before the war and after the war. They still did the same thing every day. What do you feel? And so it wasn't like they weren't starving, but their practice stayed the same, and that's what he admired. And I'm asking you to reflect, what do you feel about this very positive picture of monastic life? Can you use it for your own life, like make everything you do into a practice? And or even can you see why this would be helpful, even? Why would it be helpful to make everything that you do into a practice? And fifth, this is when Katagiri was with his first teacher and bored. He says, but I hated it because I was always looking for something exciting. I was always greedy, but my teacher didn't care. He just lived. He just let me be alive every day. But I cannot help but admire the depth of Katagiri's self-knowing and honesty. I mean, to say, you know, I hated my Zen practice and I was greedy and I just wanted, you know, excitement. That's pretty honest. It's pretty self-revealing. So I wonder if you have any similar uncomfortable traits that could ruin things for you if you really looked at them. So I'm asking you to reflect. Katagiri had this uncomfortable trait of wanting excitement all the time and getting bored when things were just kind of going along in a way for exactly what he admired about monastic life to begin with, why he went there. But then when he went, he was bored. But then when he totally immersed himself, he stopped being bored and he started being fully engaged, and he understood why Zen practice and Zazen in particular was so important. I wonder if you have any questions.
Thanks, Gail. The first question that we have is, I'm noticing how both Okumura Roshi and Katagiri Roshi were pulled into the depth of their practice reluctantly. Okumura really wasn't interested in America and didn't want to learn English, but couldn't say no to his teacher. Katagiri from birth practically was simply placed in his family's prayer room. Practice wasn't really like a choice. What is this about? Why is reluctance seemingly so present on the Dharma path?
It's so true, and it was particularly true for me. But it took me a long time to get here, like 11 years. But it was my turning point. It was the quality that, when I looked at it deeply, allowed me to see that I wasn't the person that I had designed in my mind. You know, we humans, we design ourselves, and then big surprise, we're not that person, but we're stuck there. And that means to go back to the drawing board in Zazen and allow your larger self to show us who we are. But for me, reluctance showed me that I wasn't the person that I had designed in my mind. And so then I needed to find out, well, then who am I? And reading the reluctance carefully allowed me to correct myself. It was very important. But you make a good point about reluctance, you know, did show up in both Okumura's story. You know, he just totally couldn't care less about coming to America, but he just couldn't tell Uchiyama Roshi, no, I don't think I want to go. He just couldn't do it. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you. That was great.
The next question that we have is, when Roshi's teacher said, oh, yes, if you want, but wherever you may go, everything is the same. Katagiri was shocked, but is that true? If I go to Hawaii for a vacation, it isn't really the same as going to Illinois.
Katagiri Roshi's teacher knew that Katagiri was looking for excitement, and he knew that he wouldn't find it in the Pure Land School. He also knew that Buddhist practice is based on daily routine, And he just stated that truth. And it's very helpful, because you could go to Illinois and have an even better time than going to Hawaii, because we take ourselves wherever we go. And if you're alert and ready in Illinois and look at everything with fresh eyes, you might find it beautiful in a completely different way from Hawaii, and find something there that touches you that you might not have found on that, in that particular trip to Hawaii. In Katagiri's case, he would have gotten bored with Pure Land Buddhism like in 2 weeks. And instead he went to Aheiji, and he got more involved rather than less. And that's what satisfied. And I've seen this principle work in other settings as well. sometimes somebody will be coming once a week to psychotherapy and saying, well, I think I want to cut back to every other week. This isn't always the case. But in that particular case, it's actually, it'd be better. Why don't you come twice a week? And that's because it's that same, they're kind of losing touch with the essence. They've lost the heart of it. And the increased intensity has more of a chance of getting the heart back than lessening the intensity, which probably you'll drop the whole thing. So I think that's a really important lesson here. And probably his teacher was right. Oh, well, sure, you can go, but everywhere, no matter where you go, is the same. I think so. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. We have another question. Can you share more about who you designed yourself to be and how you realized that wasn't you?
Yes. I designed myself to be a Zen priest. It's so ridiculous. It's ridiculous because I'm 100% not suited to living in a community. Unlike almost everybody, I'm distinctly not suited. And so a priest is like in service of the community, that a priest's life is offering herself to others entirely. Like I serve, I'm here for this community in whatever way, whatever is needed. And I'm in tune with it. I participate in everything. I care enormously. And, you know, I'm a poet. I read and I write, and that's alone in my room. And so I went through the strenuous entryway to get to Tassajara, and then underwent the strenuous practices of a Zen monastery and stayed for a long time until I finally noticed, took me forever to notice that I hated everything. I hated everything. I didn't want to do anything. And the way it looked was, I said, people would ask me to do something. Oh, would you help with the dishes after dinner, Gail? Oh, okay, I said, oh, okay. And that was when in my discovery, I realized that, oh, okay meant I detest this with my entire being. That's what oh, okay meant for me. You know, I really didn't belong there, and I didn't care about the community. And I think I've confessed this to you before. I mean, it's too painful to even say, but during the fires, you know, I sort of, well, if Tassajara would just burn down, then I wouldn't have to be here. I mean, I didn't want to be there that bad. And it's awful to say that. So I had designed myself as a Zen priest, and I was more than any other student there unsuited for that vocation. But I had it in my mind. I asked my teacher to ordain me, and he kept putting it off. What can I say? it was so misguided and such a so painful, the whole thing. And even now, just to say one more word, I think in the real truth is that I'm not actually a Zen student, because my practice, not today actually, but who I am, the correct practice for me is the way of poetry. And that's who I am. And I still practice the way of poetry, even though I also practice Zazen every day. But from the standpoint of the way of poetry, I also practice Zazen. Not from the standpoint of a Zen student, where if they did Zazen all day, every day, that would be the best. You know, that's actually what Dogen feels it. Zazen only. I mean, he really sincerely feels that it's so important that it's. Dogen has said that when you evaluate your daily life actions, if they aren't like our ancestors, they're useless. He's actually said that. If our actions don't resemble the actions of our ancestors, they're useless. He said that. So I'm not living that way. And I feel like to be a real Zen student of my lineage, that would be what I would be designing myself after. And it just, my practice in my marrow, bones, and skin, as they say in Buddhism, is the way of poetry. So sometimes I think, are you really even a Zen student, Gail? I'm not sure. But I hope that answered your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next comment that we have is, Robert Thurman ends with what he calls the best advice for Buddhist social action I've yet seen, referring to Dogen's four methods of guidance, which he calls the four political practices: giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. That was kind of an eye-opener for me.
I know. It's kind of like a wake-up call that everything we do, even small actions, are political because of our interconnectedness. You know, the interconnected co-arising of all beings is our nature. And so anything we do affects the whole mix. And it makes Jane Austen's theme of manners into a social action teaching completely relevant for today, because she studies how people treat each other and their growing understanding of beneficial as opposed to destructive action in terms of ultimate self-happiness and social harmony. So for her, generosity and kind speech are at the heart of it. She teaches in her writing these four methods, these four kind of, she teaches giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action in practically every sentence. And so what you're saying is really like, knock, knock, think, pay attention, notice everything you do, how you place a cup in the sink, you know, how you turn out a light. Isan Dorsey used to say, you know, I don't clean to make things clean. I clean to make things feel that they're being paid attention to. So that with that kind of attention, with the heart of these four beneficial actions, I think it's actually a good way to go in almost any situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The last one that we have is, don't expect helping to be a big deal. In our everyday life, we can help someone or something all the time. This obvious remark somehow was a big reminder for me. The other day, I was parking my car in my building's garage, and a woman came running over to me because her keys, fob's battery was dead. So could I open the door for her? When I did, she was so relieved. It sort of made my day. What if she hadn't run over to me? This isn't really a question, I guess.
You know, it's again, it's the same thing of this interconnectedness. You know, she went up to get up to, with using her key fob to swipe the door. And if the battery was dead, you know, she's stuck. She can't do anything until someone comes along, or she gets someone, and she got me. And I was, or me being this person. But that's a gift, right? That's one of those gifts from the universe that we talk about, that everything is a gift. And the woman coming up to you and asking for help, and you were able to help her. It reminds me of this interconnectedness, reminds me of, I lost a lot of time on a work project because a coworker's wife's parents' friend needed them to come and travel to a pretty far away and help them. And because of this, his wife's parents' friends needed something in Colorado, I think it was, I wasn't able to make any progress for like a month on this something that I'm working on. And that's, again, this is that interconnectedness that it's there, and we don't pay enough attention to it. We lose our understanding that this is our reality, actually. I see I'm out of time, and I want to thank especially my team today. I feel so grateful that we're able to be here and do this. Brendan and Sahar and Brian, who's not able to be here today. I'm very grateful for your help. Thank you so much. And we'll have our last talk in the series next week. Bye-bye.